serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. James Tiptree Jr. was one of the most highly regarded science fiction writers of the 1970s. His work was dark and hard-edged and erotic. It was often praised for its muscularity. Sometimes his writing was compared with Ernest Hemingway. At the same time, it seemed that Tiptree had an uncommon understanding of women, particularly the kind of anger and frustration that could be the result of living in a society dominated by men. The author himself was something of a mystery because no one had ever met him face to face or talked with him. And it was generally assumed that James Tiptree Jr. was a pen name, but it was also generally assumed that whoever was writing these stories, it was a man. And when occasionally it was suggested that, well, maybe that these stories could have been written by a woman, other writers and a lot of other science fiction writers, both men and women, said, no way, there's no way these stories could have been written by a woman. Well, as it turns out, they were. In 1976, it was revealed that, in fact, James Tiptree was a woman named Alice Sheldon, a woman who, even before that, had lived a very interesting life. Now there is a new biography out. It's titled James Tiptree Jr., The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and our guest this morning is the author, Julie Phillips. She's written about books, film, feminism, and cultural politics for a number of publications, Newsday, Interview, Mademoiselle, Ms., and The Village Voice, where her original articles on James Tiptree Jr. appeared. She was born in Seattle. She worked as a journalist in New York. She now makes her home in Amsterdam with her family, but she's back here in the United States and is, I believe, in Seattle today and is talking with us by telephone. Ms. Phillips, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
We certainly appreciate it. You know, I guess off and on throughout my life, I've been a reader of science fiction, but I had never read any Tiptree. So when we got this program set up, I hied myself down to the library and got a couple of collections of stories and have been reading the stories. And what strikes me, and I, you know, I don't know if my reading is influenced by the fact that I know who wrote them, but I think about all of the other writers that before her identity was revealed, all of them who said in such strong terms, said stuff like, no way could a woman have written this. No way. And men said that and women said that. When I read the stories, I see what seems to me to be a very strong feminist viewpoint. And you know, I don't know if I would have been so much aware of it if I had thought James Tiptree was a man. But again, it brings me back to all those people who just said over and over again, no way. Oh, no woman could possibly have written these stories.
Well, like a lot of hoaxes, it works. It worked because people wanted to believe it. It was the 1970s. Feminism was a new thing, and everybody wanted to know if a man could be a feminist. And here was this wonderful feminist man who, you know, this guy who clearly, you know, was clearly masculine because, you know, he wrote from a male viewpoint, his characters were interested in women. He wrote about, you know, he wrote especially in his letters about hunting and, not hunting, fishing and, you know, politics. And he wrote about the CIA. What do women know about the CIA? He'd been in the army, must be a man. You know, all of it was true, of course, but, you know, Alice Sheldon really used people's expectations in certain ways. And like I said, you know, everybody said, this man, he understands. It's true. A man can be a feminist.
Yeah. And the other thing, though, I think is also, to me, I think comes through in the work is an understanding of and a sympathy for for male pride and how, mm-hmm. and how vulnerable it can be. You know, mm-hmm. wounded male pride, I think, also is a real theme of a lot of these stories.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that she, I think, in some of the dark places that both men and women have, you know, their fears, their frustrations, what they want and how it feels when you don't get it, I think that she had a pretty good understanding of how that feels on both sides of the gender divide.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, she has a real sympathy for her male characters, I think. She likes them. Mm-hmm. Even in a story like The Women Men Don't See, which is about two women who would rather leave Earth with a bunch of, you know, with an alien exploring party than stick around with, you know, to have to live with men anymore.
Yeah.
It's not really clear which side she's on. It's not clear whether, you know, she thinks that the women are right or she thinks that they're really nutty.
Because they're two they're these two very strong sort of voices and viewpoints offered in that story. One is the woman's point, where she articulates what it's like to be a woman in a male-dominated society and in a male-dominated occupation, and yet there's this man. So here, the woman speaks very clearly the woman's frustration and experience, and then the man kind of sonnet. So, you know, depending on who of these characters you in a sense want to you most identify with, then you could say, well, maybe the story has one viewpoint or the other viewpoint, and I suppose in a sense it has both viewpoints.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it does. You know, the disadvantage of the woman's viewpoint in that story is that it's hopeless. You can't do anything to change anything on Earth. And the advantage to the male viewpoint is that it's, you know, he's invulnerable in a way. He doesn't really let anything bother him.
Yeah, and the women, the one particularly the woman, and it's a mother and a daughter, and particularly the mm-hmm. the woman here has, as you say, she would rather than put up with what life is like for her. It's the devil you know and the devil you don't. She's actually willing to take herself and her daughter off with. That's a strange twist in the story about when the aliens show up. But you know, the idea is that she's so willing to go for something else mm-hmm. to see what other possibilities there would be. She feels so boxed in by her life here that she would just as soon go off with aliens than keep living the life that she had been living.
Mm-hmm.
And there, it seems that there are a lot of people in these stories that also do that, that they're so, that they feel so sort of hemmed in and so frustrated and so limited and so, you know, that their dreams have been squashed at so many times that they're willing to, you know, put the pedal down and head off to who knows where, but anywhere would be better than where they are. I think that's kind of, it seems that they're, that kind of feeling is in a lot of these stories too.
Yeah, there's an... almost a suicidal dream of escape on the part of some of Tiptree's characters. And often the stories do end in death. I think that Alice Sheldon had trouble imagining positive endings for those characters who just, they just want to get out at any cost.
And she, obviously, she also had a hard time imagining a positive ending for herself.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we're sort of getting ahead of the story, but in fact, she committed suicide in 1987.
Seven.
Is that right? And it's something that apparently she had been thinking about for some time. She was married. Her husband was older. He was ill. She apparently couldn't quite imagine a life without him. And was feeling, seems that she felt that at the end of her road in a lot of ways, and that there was nothing, nowhere else to go. And she apparently, at the time that she died, had been feeling that for some time.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to put it, at the end of her road.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the hope that she saw was in writing, in trying to express these feelings for a future generation. To trying to change things so that the so future people wouldn't have to go through what she went through.
Mm-hmm. She had a remarkable life, and we should talk about some of her life up before she started writing science fiction, because that shaped her in so many ways, and the sort of this persona, James Tiptree, was really her. I think that's one of the ways that she justified using the pen name, because she said, she would have said something to the effect of, well, yeah, I said I was a man, but other than that, everything else I said was actually me.
She didn't ever say that she was a man. She said that her name was James Tiptree Jr., but within that, she never said, she's very careful not to say when I was a boy or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But the sort of details that she provided about the life of James Tiptree and the thing were actually, it was actually her life. And that's how it is that later on she was kind of outed, because she had actually been giving out details about who she really was other than, other than giving her name. And so that it was very, I think she felt that it wasn't really, that she still had been basically honest, that the voice that she was writing in was hers, that the kind of experiences that had shaped her really were hers, and that she was in fact that, she was that person in everything but name.
Absolutely, I agree, yeah. In fact, I think that she was more honest about herself as Tiptree in some ways than she was as herself, partly because there were certain things she felt like she could say as Tiptree that she couldn't say as herself, either because they came across as more believable in a male biography, or just because, you know, wearing a mask makes it possible to say things that you can't say face to face. I also think that she didn't make up, you know, she didn't embellish her stories quite so much when she was Tiptree. I think she was, you know, having told this big lie and pretending to be someone else, she was a little bit more careful about the, you know, the little embroideries.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Julie Phillips. She's the author of a newly published biography of Alice Sheldon, who wrote science fiction under the name James Tiptree Jr. The book is just recently out. St. Martin's Press is the publisher. It's a very interesting story, so you might want to take a look at the book. And, of course, questions would be welcome, as always, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. She had, to say the least, an interesting, unusual, unconventional childhood. Well, let's talk about that, and talk about her her parents. Tell us about her mom and dad.
Well, her she grew up in Chicago, and her father was a lawyer and a real estate developer, and her mother was a writer of popular fiction, the kind that got published in the Saturday Evening Post, and made tons of money. I think that was what people did before they had TV, was read these stories. And so she, during the Depression, she supported the whole family as a writer, and, you know, in style too, in, you know, mink coats and finishing schools for Alice. Sold stories to the movies and had a sideline. They had a sidelight, and that was African exploration. They went to Africa for the first time in 1921 with Carl Akeley, who was a naturalist and big game hunter. And they went to the mountains of Rwanda to hunt mountain gorillas for the American Museum of Natural History. So it's a diorama of mountain gorillas that were shot by Alice's father and by Carl Akeley. And they took Alice along with them. She was an only child. She was six, or she turned six on the boat going over. And they sort of had her carried through Africa with them. And they went back again twice, once when she was nine and once when she was 15. And her mother wrote books about it. Three books for adults, travel books, and two books for children with Alice in the starring role. So she was narrated by her mother before her, you know, her story belonged to her mother when she was a kid in certain ways. That I think one of the reasons she became Tiptree was to be able to tell her own stories and sort of get that back from her mother. Not that her mother was awful or anything, but just, you know, she was in these circumstances where she had a mother who was a writer that she, you know, who was in competition with her in certain ways, and she needed to take extreme measures to get around that, I guess.
There are just some remarkable photographs of her in the book as a little girl in Africa. I'm looking, there's one here where she's standing in this photo. She looks like Shirley Temple. She's wearing a little white dress. She's wearing a pith helmet, but she's standing in front of a group of Kikuyu warriors. And there's another on a later trip when she was nine, when she is shown posed sitting up against a dead elephant, which has just been shot. And it's just remarkable to think about what that might have been like for her. And I suppose if you think what kind of childhood would be appropriate for someone who later is going to write about going to another planet, well, I would imagine that probably at this time for her that was maybe a little bit like going to another planet. It would have been that different from the place where she had been born and where she grew up.
Absolutely. When the first time she saw Star Trek, she said, "That's a story about my childhood." And, you know, a lot of science fiction stories about colonization, et cetera, are based on, you know, 19th century stories about travels to Africa, about, you know, stories about the American West.
Yeah. Her parents were these socialites in Chicago, and yet they had this interesting sort of other life. It seemed that she really resisted, though, the debutante role, the idea of her being folded into that kind of society with the constraints on what you could do as a woman must have just been too much. The idea, even, I don't know how she would have articulated it. She probably wouldn't have called herself a feminist at the time, but it seemed that role was just something that she felt she just couldn't do it.
Well, she tried to do it. I think she was really infatuated with that role for a while. She was very beautiful. And, you know, if you're beautiful and a debutante, you get a ton of attention and a lot of, you know, a lot of rewards for playing that role. And I think that part of her really enjoyed that, but she just couldn't. She couldn't go through with it in the end. And so she did. She didn't talk her mother out of making her into a debutante, and she did make her debut, and I think she had a good time. And, you know, 5 days later, she ran off with the boy who had been seated on her left at the party and got married to him in Waukegan in the middle of the night.
And that would be Bill Davey?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about him. This was her first husband. This was a relatively short, I guess, a relationship lasted over a few years, at least.
Yeah, 6 years. He was at her debut because his stepfather was Cyrus McCormick, Jr. He was the son of a painter, Randall Davey, who lived out in Santa Fe and was kind of a bon vivant and gave a lot of great parties. And they divorced when he was a teenager, and his mother married this fabulously wealthy Chicago heir to the International Harvester fortune. And that life didn't quite fit him either, and so I think that he was glad to get out of it. So they were partners in crime in a certain way, although they were always sort of running back to their parents for money. And he wanted to be a writer, and she wanted to be a painter. And so they went off and lived this sort of dissolute life and had a lot of arguments. I think, you know, he was kind of a Byronic anti-hero of the kind that she probably really wanted to be. A lot of, I think, women who marry these sort of wild adventurous types would really rather be them, and then, you know, being married to one isn't nearly as much fun.
Yeah, well, he looks like, there are some pictures of him here. He was a handsome guy for sure, mm-hmm. A handsome young man. Looks like he was almost like movie star handsome. You could see him here. There's a picture of him wearing jeans and a jean jacket and a cowboy hat. You could see him being in a Western movie for sure.
Absolutely. Very, very handsome and very charming and very difficult.
Hmm. It was not that long after they got divorced that she joined the Army.
Yeah, I think, she went back to Chicago and she lived with her parents, and they got her a job as the art critic for the Chicago Sun, which had just started. And that was fun, but it didn't really fit her sense of the dramatic, and all the men that she knew were, you know, this was 1942, and all the men that she knew were joining the Army, including Bill Davey. And she wanted to do something dramatic. She wanted to serve her country. She took flying lessons for a while, but she washed out of flight school. And so eventually she, you know, when they started the Women's Army Corps, she joined as a private. And I think they had her drawing, they put her to work drawing her company Christmas card. And so she got herself sent to Officer Canada. Canada after that.
What she did was she went on to work in doing intelligence work, or it was aerial. She was interpreting aerial photographs to pick out targets for bombing.
Exactly. Yeah, she was. She was a photo interpreter, and their job was to assess these aerial reconnaissance photos for damage after bombing and for sort of, you know, bombing interest beforehand. And she did that for a while and eventually produced a whole series of manuals on oil refineries and munitions plants to show people, you know, what it was they were supposed to drop the bombs on, and it, you know, if anything they might have hit afterward.
And it was when she was in the military then that she met the man that would be her second husband, and would be her husband till the time of their death. And we'll talk a little bit about that, how that happened. This was Huntington Sheldon.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of man was he?
Hard to get a handle on, I found. Very reserved, had come from an upper-class New England background, was very handsome, had grown up in England. His father ran the London office of an investment, New York investment bank, and had been sent to boarding schools from the age of six. Sort of, I think, aloof if you first met him, and then, you know, inside, very funny and kind of an oddball, which I think was his attraction for Alice, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. And it was then sometime after the war, she and he were asked to join the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things did they do in the CIA?
Well, he was asked to join at a pretty high level. He became the, I believe, the director of current intelligence. His job was to supervise a group of analysts who produced a letter, a one- or two-page document that the CIA director used to brief the president daily. And, very responsible job, although as one of the people who worked with him said to me, it's hard to get someone to read a piece of news that they don't like, or a piece of analysis that they don't like, which, you know, I think we've seen in the current situation.
Mm-hmm.
And she was asked to join at a much lower level. She was brought in, again, as a photo interpreter and went to work in what was then a very sleepy department. That was just before the U-2 spy planes and the satellites. And so she quit that and got reassigned to counterintelligence, counterespionage, basically following nationalist movements in Africa to see if any of them were going to, getting aid from the Russians. But the whole thing only lasted about 3 years. She wanted to write ever since she had worked for the Chicago Sun. She had wanted to write. And she couldn't write and work full-time, and she got very stressed out, and she was using too much Dexedrine. And so one day, apparently, she up and quit and ran off and hid out for a couple of weeks, presaging, I think, her disappearance or as Tiptree.
Mm-hmm. She also then went back to, or went to college, and went through it, and she got a PhD in psychology. What interested her about psychology?
The book that she wanted to write was about aesthetics. She was going to write this 3-volume study of the psychology of perception. She wanted to know what made paintings good, and she wanted to look for that in the eye of the beholder. She wanted to study the psychology of the way that we look at art. And I think that had to do with her early career as a painter, that she was trying to find out about perspectives on painting in order to explore and defend her own perspective. She quit painting after she left Bill Davey, and just before she joined the Army. She had really had, major ambitions as a painter, and one day she just up and quit, which doesn't happen very often. And I think that she was worried about her material, that her material was getting too personal, and that studying aesthetics and psychology was both a way of backing off from that and sort of disappearing into this abstract study, and of defending what it was that she really wanted to say, defending herself against, you know, her parents who wanted her to be a debutante and the society that wanted her to be a sweet little girl.
The guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Julie Phillips. She is the author of a newly published biography of Alice Sheldon, who wrote science fiction under the pen name James Tiptree Jr. The book is James Tiptree Jr., The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon, published by St. Martin's Press. Our guest has done a lot of various kinds of writing. She's written about books, film, feminism, and cultural politics for Newsday, Interview, Mademoiselle, Ms., The Village Voice, where she wrote articles on James Tiptree. And this book is just recently out, and it's a very interesting story. You might want to take a look at it. It's in the bookstores. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that Alice Sheldon wanted to write. Why did she decide, or how is it that she started writing science fiction?
She had always read science fiction and loved science fiction and kind of looked down on science fiction because she thought that she was supposed to write great literary genius stuff. She was really brought up as this precocious child. She was really brought up to think that she was a genius and had to be a genius in order to satisfy her parents' expectations. And so was so sort of caught up in this notion of genius that, of course, she couldn't write anything at all. Or, you know, she wrote drafts of things and didn't publish very much. And so she just started writing. She had been writing science fiction stories, and one day she was finishing her thesis, and she needed to give herself a break, and she just kind of tossed off these science fiction stories. And they got published. She submitted them, and they got published. So it was a genre where she could play and have fun and also, I think, talk about things that she couldn't say as herself. You know, writers get told to write what they know, but science fiction, I think, is a genre for writing about what you don't know that you know.
The first stories, were they published under her own name?
She had published one story in The New Yorker in 1946, as by Alice Bradley, that was about her experiences in the army in Germany in 1945. And she submitted a story to the science fiction magazines in 1952 under a female pseudonym, but that wasn't accepted. One editor said, hey, if you do some rewrites, I'll take it. But she had just gotten a job at the CIA, and for whatever reason, she didn't do it. She had, you know, as Tiptree, she used to say, oh, well, I just started writing one day, and all these stories got accepted. So one of the things that surprised me when I first started researching her was how very long she had been writing, how long her writing apprenticeship was.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can imagine the alter ego functioning on a variety of levels in one sense, because as you say, there seemed to be, for her, it was a kind of a mask through which she could speak and say things that she couldn't as herself. Maybe also she felt that the writing would be more accepted if people thought this was a man. And maybe also she, in a way, maybe she was also interested in protecting her identity of Alice Sheldon just because of this other life that she had. So, you know, when you have this question, well, why is it that she couldn't have written these stories under her own name? It sounds as if the answer to that question is actually not simple. It's actually fairly complicated.
Yeah, there are lots and lots of reasons. I think it's a fascinating story about writing because a lot of writers talk about feeling like they have another self who does their work for them, that they become somebody else when they're writing. And, you know, with her, it was, in a sense, literal.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to be the case that once, and we can talk at some point about the circumstances of how it is that her actual identity became known, but once it did become known, that it hurt her writing, that somehow when she felt that she lost that mask, that she couldn't wear it anymore, that it for her that it just wasn't the same.
I think that's partly true. I think actually she started having a lot of trouble writing a couple of years before her identity was revealed. That was in late 1976. But in 1974, she won two science fiction awards. One of her stories won a Nebula Award, and the other one won a Hugo. And she, after that, really made her writing much more difficult because she started feeling like she had to do something really worthy, that she had to write a novel, and until then she'd just been writing short stories. And she didn't like writing a novel. It was very uncomfortable. She didn't have the same inspiration. She liked working in the short form much better, but she felt like she had to write a novel because that's what everybody expected of her. She felt like it had to be really good, that, you know, and all of a sudden here she was, she felt like she had to be a genius again, and she couldn't play with her work anymore. And that made it very difficult for her to write. And when her identity was revealed, it became that much worse. And she also, don't forget, just before her identity was revealed, her mother died, with whom she'd been very close all those years. And that depressed her and made her question her identity in certain ways, too.
Hmm. As you mentioned, she won these two. These are the two. The Hugo and the Nebula are the two big, prestigious awards for writing science fiction. And it means, I'm sure, to any writer to have won one of these awards, it's very significant. It's a big deal. And of course, she couldn't turn up to accept the awards because that would mean she would say, "Well, actually, I'm not James Tiptree. I'm me, Alan Sheldon." What did they do? Did they just put him in a box and send them to her?
Well, she had a good friend who was a big fan of her writing, named Jeffrey Smith. And she lived just outside Washington, D.C., and he lived in Baltimore. And it happened that when she won the Hugo Award, it was given out at a science fiction convention in Washington. And he got up to accept the award for her. And there were tons of speculations at that point about her identity, and one of them was that it was really Jeff Smith. So he, poor guy, totally embarrassed, gets up to get this award. And then a Hugo Award is sort of shaped like a bowling trophy. It's got with a rocket ship on it, and he didn't know how to pack it up and put it in a box. He was afraid it would get broken, so he just drove to McLean, Virginia, where Tiptree had a P.O. box, and he handed it to the woman at the P.O. box window and paid the postage and said, "Here, please give this to Mr. Tiptree."
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening in Champaign on our line 4 right here. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Interesting program, fascinating. Yeah, actually, you guys kind of stole a little bit of my thunder because while I was waiting, my question was actually the process of how, I guess for lack of a better term, she was outed as to becoming a woman. I think your guest touched on it a little bit. I was just curious as to actually, you know, how that actually came about and when it came about. And then I was just curious, I know you mentioned that she had committed suicide in 82, and I was wondering if that was, in fact, after the death of her husband, you know, what he died from, I'm guessing probably cancer, and if out of that union, if they had any children. And I'll go ahead and take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Well, those are all good parts of the story. Let's take the first question, and you can tell the story about how it was. And I believe this was in 1976, or maybe it was 1977, when it was revealed that, in fact, James Tiptree was Alice Sheldon.
Well, you know, as we've been saying, Tiptree talked about his real life quite a bit and using the real details of Alice Sheldon's life. And he had said that his parents were African explorers and that his mother lived in Chicago. He was always saying, you know, oh, I have to go off to Chicago to take care of my aged mother. And so when his mother finally died at age 94, he told various people, you know, my mother died. I won't be able to, you know, I won't be able to answer letters very much for a while. And he asked his one friend, Jeff Smith, to print that in a fanzine. Can you just tell people, you know, if you don't hear from me, it's because my mother died. And Jeff Smith said, yeah, maybe you shouldn't print that. That's, you know, people might look up the obituary and discover your identity. And then he thought, you know, I'm just going to check and see how hard that would be to find. And, you know, he told me, you know, I thought I was going to find out this guy's name was James Johnson and so what. So he went to the library and got a copy of the Chicago Tribune, found the obituary, and listed under survivors was one child, a daughter, Alice Sheldon. And so he wrote to Tiptree and said, hey, look, you know, I just found this out. And what do you want me to tell people? Because if I can find this, other people can find this too. And she decided to come clean.
She, during the course of her career as James Tiptree, became friends with and had a long correspondence with a number of other science fiction writers, among them Ursula Le Guin, who for some time, and again, because she couldn't meet people in person, she couldn't go out, she didn't do interviews, she didn't do appearances, but she did correspond with people by letter. Here were now these people who felt that they knew him, mm-hmm. who when they realized that in fact it was a different situation than they thought. For people like Ursula Le Guin or other science fiction writers, particularly those men who had gone on the record as saying in such strong terms that there's no way this could be a woman, how did they react to the fact that in fact James Tiptree was Alice Sheldon?
Yeah, Tiptree did write wonderful letters, and he was this very attractive figure by mail. But he had, I think because, you know, Alice had been so honest about herself, nobody really felt betrayed by it. Everybody, you know, took it in the best possible light. I think the very first person that Alice came out to was Ursula Le Guin, because that was the one, that was the friend that she felt the closest to. And, you know, Ursula wrote this great letter sort of welcoming Allie and accepting her into science fiction, although it took them a little while to get their friendship back to what it was, because a lot of correspondents of Tiptree's talk about how sad they felt in certain ways because they had really loved Tiptree, and, you know, now they had Alice Sheldon. And it was a different person. They felt like they'd gained somebody and lost somebody.
Mm. Were fans fairly accepting as well, or was there any sort of anger or discontent or unhappiness that somehow people felt that there had been some kind of deception brought off?
I don't think so. Not as far as, I mean, she certainly felt like people were unhappy with her or had or were less interested in Alice Sheldon, the woman, than they were in Tiptree, the man. But I think that was her feeling, her sort of sense that women were second-class citizens and, oh, no, now she was about to become one again, than the reality, you know, except that women are second-class citizens. But other than that, I think people, you know, pretty quickly found out that Alice Sheldon was just as interesting a person as James Tiptree. Mm. And, you know, lots of people, I think, were really delighted by the deception.
The caller also raised a question about the events at the end of her life. This was 1987.
It was in 1987. She had been depressed at that point for a long time. She was 71 in 1987, and her husband was 84. He was in failing health. He was nearly blind. She had nursed her mother to the age of 94, and I think didn't want to go through that again, strongly felt that she didn't, you know, that she and her, she would prefer that she and her husband not, you know, sort of decline and physically or mentally, and would rather, you know, go while we're still us, is how she put it. And so she talked him into a suicide pact. And she, you know, when they decided to go through with it, she shot him, called her lawyer, called her stepson, told them what she had done, and then shot herself in the middle of the night.
And this, it seems that this is something that she had thought about, perhaps even planned for some time, because the suicide note that she left had been written years before and was just there waiting.
Yeah, she also mentions the suicide pact in her journal as early as 1978 or 1977 or 78.
We have about 10 minutes, maybe a little bit less, in this part of Focus 580. Again, I'd just like to introduce our guest once again, Julie Phillips. She's the author of a new biography of Alice Sheldon. The book is James Tiptree, Jr., The Double Life of Alice Sheldon. St. Martin's Press is the publisher. Alice Sheldon wrote a number of very successful, highly praised science fiction stories under the pen name James Tiptree, Jr., that were published. I think the first one was published in 1967. Is that?
Yeah, except in 67, published in 68.
Okay. Published in 1968 and then wrote through the 70s. And when was the last story published?
Oh, a year or two after her death, I think.
Okay. So basically, the I think a lot of people would have said the peak of her work would have been, say, the early to mid 1970s, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there, it's all in print, and you can go. There are a number of story collections, and I'm sure that people are, if you're interested in reading, if you've never read James Tiptree, and you like science fiction, I'd say, well, you certainly should go out and take a look at the work, because it's out there and it's available for you to read.
Yeah, there's a story collection called Her Smoke Rose Up Forever. That's her best of collection.
That's one of the ones that I have been reading from myself, and it does have some very strong stories, like the ones that we have mentioned, like the women that men don't. The women that men don't notice, is that
women that men don't see.
That's certainly one of them. I particularly like, there's a story called The Girl Who Was Plugged In that I really like a lot. That's very, very interesting, you know, considering now our interest in things like artificial intelligence and how pervasive the culture of marketing is all around us. Mm. That's a very interesting story. I think the thing that also strikes me about some of these stories is how the themes of the stories, the things that obviously that she was interested in and working with and worrying about and writing about, are still have the same kind of power. Really, I think you know, there are some science fiction doesn't.
He was way ahead of his time.
Yeah, the stories, they don't seem to have aged, really. They still, I think, really pack a real punch.
Yeah, I mean, that story in particular is sometimes called the first cyberpunk story. It's an early story about how people are mediated by technology, how you know, you aren't really living your own life anymore. You're living somebody's life that you saw on TV.
Yeah, and it's I don't want to give too much about the story away, but sort of the premise of the story is that a large company has created a person, in a sense, and they want to use that person to sell things, because it takes place at a time in the future when advertising has been made illegal. So the only way that they can do it is in a sense to do product placement and have this person that they have created basically go around talking about how wonderful all this stuff is, so that then other people will see that and think, well, I should have that too. And about the fact that they actually have another person, a real person who, and I'm not doing a very good job with this, is sort of linked with the body. So you have an individual that's living through, by remote control, in a sense, this other body. And it's
this other, you know, very unsatisfactory, very unattractive body of a woman who doesn't want to be herself, and so is delighted to sort of abandon her body and be locked in a cabinet so that she can reanimate the body of this beautiful girl.
And then it's also about how blurred things become about who is who, and which I think is maybe also a theme that runs through a lot of the stories. At least there, a lot of the stories seem to do with this, with a kind of a yearning to make contact with an other, and in the stories, of course, the other ends up often being extraterrestrial. But you know, sometimes I think it's just the kind of other contact has to do with contact across the gender line, and about how sometimes, I know it's a terrible cliche about this, women from one planet and men from another planet, but that they're on some level. It can be like that. And so it can, I imagine she also was thinking about the difficulty of communicating across the gender line as being something like, maybe the difficulty of communicating across some kind of species line that you might imagine there being. And that yearning for that kind of connection is something that you see, I think you see a lot in these stories as well.
Absolutely. Although she was, even though she was married twice, she was, she had very strong feelings for women, and I think some of that might be about, that desire for a connection, for a romance that seemed to her impossible.
And that was not something that she ever even attempted to do, even though she might have in her heart yearned for something like that. It was not something that she ever acted on.
Yeah, she was much too attached to respectability. She still wanted, in certain ways, to be this beautiful debutante. And, I think it's hard to imagine now just how beyond the pale it was to have an affair with another woman in those days.
And just, you think about how earlier we were talking about the fact that maybe before her identity was revealed, some people had trouble with the idea that James Tiptree could have been a woman because of the kind of background, obviously, the writer had. And yet then we talked about the fact that she was that person, that she did have this remarkable background. Yeah, she was in the Army. She was in the CIA. She was the person. And so you can see in so many ways her real life experience and the kinds of things that she felt and the personal conflicts that she had and whatever demons she was haunted by, all of that stuff went into the work. And it's something that maybe you can appreciate more when you learn about her life and you can actually see all of that. And then when you read the stories that somehow, maybe one can make too much of that, but you can see how much of the work really was a reflection of her inner life and her experience and the kinds of things that she went through.
Well, I really hope that the book will give people a starting point for reading the stories and going back to her work and talking about her work and, thinking about what it meant. Because I definitely don't feel like I have the final word. I think there's still a lot more to say about her work.
Well, I know that you've been working on this for a long time. You put many years of work into this book, many years of research. What first attracted you to Ella Sheldon?
Well, as I was saying, I thought it was such a wonderful story about writing. And it would, in a way, I would have been interested even if she hadn't become a man, even if, she had just, had to turn herself into somebody else. I think that I was probably fascinated with her taking on a disguise. I think everybody has fantasized at one time or another about becoming someone else or pretending to be someone else. And not very many people actually go through with it because, logistically it's kind of a pain. And it's not very easy to carry out. But, everybody wants to sort of leave their old self behind and become somebody new and better, I think.
Yeah. There's a particular story about how someone who admired her writing just decided to drop by one day and knocked on the door and was very surprised when this woman came to the door. And she apparently persuaded her visitor that, no, there was some kind of mistake here. And the guy went away. And then it was after that that she apparently went out and got the post office box. So that kind of thing wouldn't happen again. How did she think in that period before her identity was revealed? How did she think about the possibility that sooner or later somebody would find out? Was that something that concerned her or not?
It's hard to tell. She didn't try really very hard to keep her identity concealed. And, you know, after that incident, people didn't try all that hard to look for her. Word got around that Tiptree wanted to be private, and people in the science fiction community, I think, really respected that. And, you know, there were people who could have figured out who she was and didn't try because they could see that this person wanted to be private. And in some ways, she didn't take she claimed not to take her life as Tiptree very seriously. She said, you know, oh, this is the silly joke I'm playing, and, you know, I'm corresponding with these people, but it doesn't really mean anything. But that was a kind of self-protection, too. I think it was, you know, a way of saying to herself, you know, no, I'm not, you know, pulling off this major deception and, you know, fooling hundreds of people, and partly to, you know, keep it all a game, to make, you know, to tell herself that she wasn't really taking it seriously so she could still have fun with it.
Well, we're going to have to stop. It's a great story, and I certainly appreciate you giving us some time to talk about it.
Well, thanks for calling.
Our guest, Julie Phillips. And again, if you'd like to read the book, it is James Tiptree Jr., The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon, and it is published by St. Martin's Press. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with a journalist. Her name, Catherine Jacobson Raymond, and she is the author of Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. We'll talk about memory in midlife this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look now at what's happening in Kansas City and in Chicago with commodity prices. In Kansas City, July wheat trading at $6.09 and a half, up 9 and a half. September, $6.75, up 10 and 3 quarters. July wheat in Chicago, $6.09 and a half, up 17 and a half. September, $6.21, up 19 and a quarter. December, $6.33, up 17 and a quarter. July corn, $3.38, unchanged. September, $3.44 and a half, down 1. December, $3.56 and a quarter, down 3 quarters. July beans, $8.91 and a half, up 2 and a half. August, $8.95 and a quarter, up 1 and 3 quarters. November, $9.22.